The title of the paper that is distributed is more specific one on the taxing period. I think we could, if you have read the paper, we could discuss that also, but that's what I'll do today is more to focus on this comparative perspective between these two countries, Taiwan and Thailand. What I'll do is to, what I'm going to say will be divided into two parts. The first part presents the theoretical framework that I've used. The second part comes up with the findings. Let me start by a minute. I will see when it works. My presentation is based on a monograph called State Institution and Industrial Development, Industrial Deepening and Upgrading Policies in Taiwan and Thailand. It's a 3-volume 1. There's 2.7 kilo or 1,000 pages. It's so I'm trying to compress that in into 1 hour. What I do in this monograph, and there's a copy of the first chapter and the list of content moving around, so if you want to see what the content, there's another one here. So just to get some idea about the content, you can look there. What I'm trying to do is to look at the period in 1991 to 2001 in Thailand and compare that to a comparable period in Taiwan. And a comparable period is 10 to 15 years back in the case of Taiwan. In the study, I also tried to compare the policies in Thailand after 1991 compared to prior to 1991. But I will not go into that. But if you look at the copy that circulated, you see there's also a comparison over time in Thailand. And then there's this paper that has been distributed also where it's the period after 2001. So there's a lot of different time periods covered. What I'm talking about now is the period in the 90s in Thailand compared to the 80s in Taiwan. I have studied for quite a long period, probably for a longer period, five different policy domains. Three of them are sectoral. They belong to the petrochemical plastic production chain. So I started upstream, looking at the petrochemical industry in Taiwan and Thailand, and compared them, in particular, compared the policies of the state. Then I went a bit downstream to plastic industry, plastic parts industry. So the suppliers, the plastic parts suppliers that there are, a lot of them in Thailand, and the same is in the and the same you will find in Taiwan. Then I went for this side stream, I call it, because if you want to make plastic parts, you need mold and dye, medical plastic molds, and these plastic molds had to be a good quality to make good quality plastic parts. So I looked at that in both countries. So that was three sectoral policy areas or policy domains. Then I looked at two cross-sectoral areas. The one is SME linkage policy. Look at the policies to create linkages and the policy support, in particular small-scale enterprise, small and medium-scale enterprises in Taiwan and Thailand. And finally, I looked at what I call industrial technology policy. I think a part of our promotion, yes, would call it science and innovation policy. There's a bit more emphasis on the word innovation. But actually, what I looked at is science and technology or innovation policies in Taiwan and in Thailand. Finally, another way of explaining what I've been doing is to turn to the world, to the World Bank. The World Bank has in some recent publications, I think it's only in recent publications, they're beginning to talk about the middle income trap. The main idea is it might be fairly easy, not that easy, but fairly easy to move from low income to middle income. But when you try to get from the middle income country level to the high income country level, then you might run into difficulties. So as the quote says, history shows that while many economies can reach middle income status, often quite quickly, few pass through it because the policy and institutional changes needed are more complex and more challenging technically, politically, and socially. So I think what I've been doing is what the World Bank nowadays would call what can states do to solve the middle income crisis, just to put it that way around. And it might be the World Bank to talk to about this before not 2007, but then I've just not seen it. Okay, I'll turn back to my own work. What I've been doing, the research focus, or the main research question, has been to look at the ability and the willingness of the states in Taiwan and Thailand to design and implement an adequate and coherent set of strategic industrial policies and the likely impact of such policies on what I call industrial deepening and upgrading. So that's what I've been studying on in these 1,000 pages. And I'll turn back to the details in it. What I've been doing is to combine a policy process and a process analysis. Look at the policy process, starting with agenda setting, then look at the policy formulation, and then the policy implementation, and then the likely impact. There might be no impact at all, the word likely impact. And then combine that with a political analysis, trying to look at what are the mechanisms of the politics behind the policies. So that's why I have the title, The Policies and Politics. So I look at the policies in the areas I have mentioned and look at the politics behind this. If you should place it in a kind of theoretical perspective, what I do, as you can also see in this paper that circulated, I start off with historical institutionalism. It's not rational choice institutionalism, but another type of institutionalism called historical or historic structural institutionalism. But I'm interested in the institutional arrangements and have developed concepts like the past dependency. I need to use that concept, use other concepts like critical junctures, develop theories about varieties of capitalism, different types of capitalism, etc. That's the starting point, and my particular focus is on the role of the state, so it's in the developmental state debate that was also debated much in Thailand years back, mostly with the 10 years, 15 years back. I then transform it, as you see, and I'll turn back to that, into the notion of developmental governance, and I'll say a bit more about that. Before I turn to that, I will say that the kind of policy I'm looking at, these industrial deepening and upgrading policies, are compared to macroeconomic policies, policies that are quite easy to decide upon. I mean, while macroeconomic policies like depreciation might be very difficult to decide upon, but very easy to implement when you have decided, the kind of policies I'm looking at are very are very easy to decide upon. And people can agree we want to upgrade and we want to have more linkages, but when it comes to implementation, it's quite complicated. But that's the case in all countries. But I think it's important to note that this is a particular kind of policies that are not that easy to implement. So there's a difference here between macroeconomic policies and microeconomic policies. I'm focusing on the microeconomic policies. Then let me say that I'm not, as you can hear, looking at a good governance approach. I mean, a good governance approach would be that I should focus on the rule of law, focus on control of corruption, accountability, and that kind of issues. And then the basic idea is because if you make that kind of market-sustaining interventions, you will get market efficiency in the sense that you get lower transaction costs, and these lower transaction costs should then some way or the other lead to economic growth and to poverty alleviation. I'm not following that track. I'm following what to seek another track, where the argument is that governance is not about making that kind of market sustaining, market supporting interventions. It's about it's type of governance that allows for firmly state response to changing circumstances through effective implementation of adequate strategies. So there's a strong focus on policy decisiveness. So it's about the state taking action. what I'm studying, the paper that is distributed and what I'm talking about, is that I actually looked at the Thaksin period, please. Thaksin was the man who said he was there to take action. So it took a lot of action, and the good issue is was what happened then afterwards. Was it implemented more effectively than before? And of course we can turn back to that. That's the content of the paper that was distributed. But the focus in those papers is on what I call diplomation governance. So the governance part is the first dot. Then there's the strategy part. The strategy part is about growth enhancing strategies. And what is growth enhancing strategies? What is strategies that ensure you have a high level of productive investments, that you have investments in growth sectors. So it's something about that some sectors are the growth sectors more than others, although that could be debated. It's about accumulation of technological capabilities, no literature on that. But Rapong is expert in that area, we can turn back to that. And about technological upgrading, having a higher level of productivity. So the strategy is about these things. When it comes to developmental governance then in total, one point I would stress is that rather than looking for the rule of law and combating corruption, which might be important, of course, in their own, for their own sake, I'm looking at quite openly to the kind of institutions that make it, that are relevant. Often it's not orthodox institutions, it's the one you would expect from and the objective all kinds of what I call heterodox institutions that are active in different countries. Some are formal and some are informal. And my research strategy has just been quite open in the sense I'm actually looking for the kind of institutional arrangements that are in play, not whether they fit into a particular case textbook version. Secondly, this approach also means that you would expect that different strategies or different there's not one policy package. If I look at the East Asian countries, at least in my understanding, there's quite a difference between South Korea, Taiwan, and Singapore, to take these three. It's not the same set of policies and strategies. And there's a kind of institutional pluralism, meaning that it might be a different set of institutions are in play, but you get the same result. So what you have to look for is this different set, or the same set, with another set of institutions. But we can't start out by assuming that there's only one particular set of institutions that work. We had a similar debate in the world. Some years back, people would argue that the Japanese model, the Japanese way of doing it, was really working. Probably people would not do it nowadays. Now, some people argue the Danish model should be for flexicurity, quite famous. I don't know, next year is probably another model. So it's more to illustrate that there are a variety of possible institutional success arrangements. So it's a lot also about learning and experimenting. What different countries have done is to try one thing, and when it fails, they try another thing. But they have learned along the past. So it's not something we have some smart technocrats who can take everything out in advance and then can implement it. It's not about experimenting and learning along the road. So that means that you also have to make detailed case studies that look at the experiences of successful and less successful process of economic development. So what I've done is just to pick up two countries, Taiwan and Thailand, because one could discuss why not Malaysia, South Korea, why not, etc. We can turn back to that. And what I'm interested in is not some best practice way of doing this. Is the Taiwanese model the best practice model? It's more that what works under what circumstances. And it might well be if the circumstances are not the same, then probably it's not the same thing that works. So much about the developmental governance approach, we can turn back to that. And what I've been doing is to use this model, by the little framework, it's not modeling in an economic and so it's kind of a little framework. What I've been doing is, as you can see, look at, the focus is on dynamic and sustainable industrialization. And what I'm looking at is the design and implementation of what I call strategic industrial policies. I'll turn back to that in a few minutes. Then the next, if you move down the downwards, there's a section about what states can do. Here you have the institutional capacity. In order to find out what states can do, I look at institutional capacity. It has two aspects, an internal and external. The internal about is about the organization of the bureaucracy. It's about the degree of support from the political elite. It's about bureaucratic interaction. It's about the role of ideological predispositions and the professional backgrounds of the bureaucrats. It's about the degree of bureaucratic coherence. It's about the level of bureaucratic autonomy versus undue political interference. And it's about the availability and non-availability of relevant policy instruments, the financial resources, etc., analytical capability. So there's a lot of things in this internal one, the one to the left. To the right is the state industry linkages, where I've been looking in all these cases at the external dimension of the state, the way it interacts with the business sector. And the main difference there is between an institutionalized government business cooperation, where it's institutionalized, not personalized, but institutionalized, there's a more particularistic one where it's more personalized, where you have specific links between individual entrepreneurs or businessmen and individual people in the same apparatus. But there, of course, there's a higher risk of capture, that individual entrepreneurs capture their part of the bureaucracy. But that two, there are different setups, one that is institutionalized and another that's personalized. So the middle part here that is about what states can do. So I have tried to analyze, and I'm sure I succeeded, what states can do in various fields that I've been looking at. Then, of course, is what states actually do. Because you can't go from what states can do to what they actually do. In order to find out what the states actually do, I have to look at the regime orientation. And behind that, there are the phenomenons I mentioned, geopolitics, leadership, state elite challenges, political institutions, political conflicts, political exchange relations, how the relationship between business and state, not the way that, how the relationship between business and state does business finance policies, for example, or is that not the case? Coalitional politics and legitimacy. So I've been looking at these more political factors, these political factors that are about what states actually do, but I've also been looking at what states can do by having this division between the external and the internal relations of the state. Then the notion of strategic industrial policy, there was this notion in the figure. When I talk about strategic industrial policies, and of course people could argue it's not very important with these industrial policies, because basically the market can do it, or if there's a market failure, then the state or somebody else must try to repair these market failures. That's not my approach, and of course you can discuss that. The approach is more or less to argue that in order to move from a low-growth path to a higher-growth path, if you want that, there's a need for strategic industrial policies. At least that's a hypothesis. And strategic industrial policies, they aim deliberately to foster new industrial capacity, create intersectoral and inter-industry linkages, promote learning, improve productivity, and shift the industrial structure towards higher technology and higher value-added activities that provide access to more dynamic and rewarding niches in the world market, as well as improving their competitiveness in the domestic market. So that's what I mean by, or that's the definition of strategic industrial policy. I actually argue that there's probably not one model, there's not one policy. So So what I try here in 9 points is to point at some principles that cut across, I think cut across in those cases. But these are general principles that do not presuppose a particular policy instrument. So you could use various policies and various policy instruments to have these principles. Of course, we can discuss that. But these principles, I have 9, probably too many. One is pro-investment, simply that you have a policy that channels investments from unproductive investments or capital flies onto product investments, productive investments. So there's a kind of national investment policy involved in it. That's the first one. The second one, that's a pro-technology one, or pro-innovation might be a better one, that the focus of the policy is to ensure sustained innovation. Not just one shot, but a sustained process of innovation. So that's the second point, that the pro-technology of pro-innovation. The third one is pro-competition. And of course that's related, that in a strategic industrial policy, it's not about ignoring or replacing the market. It's about shaping and using the market, not to work against firms, but to work with firms. So it's a focus on what I call superior competition. So the focus on, if you put it in that way, but of course the problem with competition is there's a kind, normally, when it's, normally when a strategic industrial policy works, there's a kind of balance between competition on the one hand and cooperation on the other hand. And it's not that easy to find that particular point of balance, because of course you need competition to ensure that firms remain innovative and responsive to shifting challenges and opportunities. But on the other hand, you need collaboration and cooperation between firms in order to get agglomeration benefits information flows into active learning and all that. What I'm saying is, it's a pro-competition, but also in a sense, pro-cooperation policy. Third, and that's related, it's about strategic integration in the world economy. It's not about de-linking or the opposite across the board opening. It's something in between where you relate yourself strategically. So you open the transnational companies, but you also work with them strategically, and you open up for trade, but you don't make an across the board opening, but you make a successive opening, etc., etc. So it's, but that's also the word strategic industrial policy, but it's also about strategic integration in the world economy. Then it's not about picking winners, it's about making winners. That means that when the existing comparative advantages are used up, is that it's cheap labor, advantages in cheap labor or natural resources, you need to move to something else, and that's where you need, I would ask you to nurture the winners, new industries, new sectors. Industries, not firms. That's important. It's selective, but not that selective. Then there's a mixture of support and discipline. I mean, in most of the successful cases, it's also the case in Taiwan, there are support measures, all kinds of support measures. So, in that sense, you give race, you could argue, to firms. But on the other hand, there's also kind of, there's a need for discipline. So the combination of giving subsidies one way or the other, protection is a kind of subsidy, but also other kinds of subsidies, then there's a need for discipline. And then the discipline could in some cases be the market, it could be the state, it could be something else, but it's important that there are some performance standards. So it's not just giveaway subsidy. There is a kind of strategy that is activity-specific and situation-specific. So it might well be you use one type of policy in some sector and another sector. It might well be that it shifts over time. Normally it will shift over time. So you will have a very stasis period followed by a very market-oriented period. But it's activity-specific and situation-specific. And finally, this policy, now I finish with that, has to be coherent and coordinated. It doesn't make sense if you have one policy going east and another going west, and I don't know where we end up, something in between. So it's quite important that the policies that are coherent in the sense that they move in the same direction. That's why you need policy packages and not just individual policies that work in all directions. So that's the notion of strategic industrial policy. And before going to the findings, just to show what I then have been doing, I've been looking at two types of I say whether we need all 9 points. Yeah, because I do agree it's a quite high requirement. It's more or less an empirical question. I mean, I'm not sure you want me all 9, or that all successful cases have used all 9. No. Because what I do, and that was the next one, what I actually do is to work only with two types of strategic industrial policy. Well, what I'm studying is not the whole set. It's two types. One is industrial deepening, and another is industrial upgrading. Industrial deepening, that policy is aimed at creating a more complete, more balanced, and more interlinked industrial structure. But that's in one end, and the other then is industrial upgrading policies. Policies aimed at fostering a more advanced and competitive industrial structure. That's the two type of policies I've been, or the two type of strategic industrial policies I've been looking at, and adjust that. And then I've been looking, as you can see, at various sub-policy pieces that I listed up in the beginning, so they're just put up here again. So I've not studied the whole set of strategic industrial policies. So there are themes that I'm not taking up in my study, but I'm taking these up. I look at basic industry policy, petrochemicals. I look at small-scale industry, linkage policy, supply development policy in both countries, and I look at industrial technology policies in both countries. And then I work in particular sectors. Let's bring in what are then the findings of these 2.7 kilo I talked about, 1,000 pages. Before I come to that, I'll just say a few things about what was the starting point, because I look at Taiwan around 1980 and Thailand around, let's say, 1990 or 91. What was the situation as far as industrial development is concerned and state intervention and industrial policies up to that moment in time? And this gives me all the opportunity to give some information, not so much about Thailand, that you know a lot about, but a bit more about Taiwan, which you might also know much about. Concerning industrial development before then is 1980 in Taiwan, it was characterized by a large state enterprise sector. It was a large state enterprise sector, and in that sector you also found all the banks. So the state was sitting on the commanding heights in a variety of sectors. Then in between you had private conglomerates sitting on the intermediate goods sector. So that means that the plastic resin sector I've been looking at, that's what private conglomerates. And then downstream there was a huge amount of SMEs producing for export. That was the structure. If you compare that with the Thailand had not that large state sector. Well, it had a state enterprise sector before 1958, but then it was downgraded quite a lot. But in China, because you have a lot of private conglomerates, as in Taiwan, but they are more spread out. They are not concentrated only in the intermediate goods production. And then you have not so many small-scale industries, or you did not have so many small-scale industries compared with Taiwan. So the economic organization, the industrial structure was not the same. As far as industrial policies is concerned, what you had in Taiwan was this mixture of import substitution and export-oriented industrialization. And it was not that some people argue there was a shift in around 1960 in Taiwan from import substitution to export orientation. I don't think that's correct. But you had a kind of zigzag, I don't know what it's called, zigzag. So you shift all the time between, or you had at the same time both import substitution strategies and export-oriented strategies, but you shift all the time and move up to still more advanced, still more technical advanced products. So what's this zigzag? That's why I call it EC-COM, EOI. While what we had in Thailand was more traditional import substitution, industrialization, and the shift mid-80s towards more export, but also towards more protection of some industries. So it's kind of prolonged import substitutions plus export from the mid-80s or early 80s, something like that. So there were differences both in the economic organization and in the industrial strategy. I think that's important when it comes to the more specific things that we are aware that there are these overall differences at the starting point. If we look at state intervention in the two cases, and I do that briefly, then I think one could argue that up to 1980 in Taiwan, there was a comprehensive industrial policy. So industrial policies that use all kinds of instruments, trade policy, foreign exchange policy, all kinds of policy instruments. In that case, it was comprehensive. It was organized in the way that it, to a large extent, protected domestic learning processes. So that was why it shifted all the time. So when the domestic learning process was had major, so to speak, then it moved to another area. So, by the way, all the time, a protection of domestic learning processes, there were selective policies, mostly for industries and for specific products, and very detailed. It could be product A that looks like product B, then you protect product A but not product B. And to some extent also to the firm level, but that was what I was asked before. There was the policies that guided transnational companies. Transnational companies were invited to Taiwan for economic reasons, but also for diplomatic reasons. It was quite nice to have a lot of transnationals if you're not recognized internationally. So they were invited in, but they were not allowed to invest in areas where you had local firms who had a strong position. So they were guided and regulated. They were also regulated in the sense that there was a service on that they should use domestic inputs. So they were encouraged or required, in some cases, to use domestic inputs. In Taiwan, industrialization took place based on domestic savings. Of course, you had these foreign investments, but basically it was domestic savings. And there is a difference between South Korea and Taiwan, because South Korea borrowed a lot of money during the same period, but that's not the case in Taiwan. Also for security reasons, it's not that good to be dependent on foreign savings. Then there was a lot of organizational learning or technical learning going on, and there were policies organized to support that. And finally, there was a strong human capital policy and a strong focus on education all the way along. I'll turn back to that later on. But that was Taiwan. When I described Thailand, that's been up to 1991, that is modest, ad hoc accommodating industrial policy, all these policies that accommodates various push and pressures from various business groups, and it shifts all the time. There's certain structural changes. Intervention where you had, of course, intervention to move capital from agriculture to industry or from some kind of industry to another kind of industry, but not at scale as in Taiwan. there were trade policy that was guided, as far as I can see, to a large extent by revenue consideration, simply because revenue from import tax was a quite important revenue in Thailand. There was a protection of vested interests, less protection of domestic learning processes than protection of vested interests, various kind of vested interests. There were little TNC regulation. Of course, there was the BOI, and they gave all these incentives. So, I mean, basically, it was not much regulation. It was more inviting TNCs to come in. There was a weak technological base that has been described in various publications. And finally, there was an unusual, inadequate education system on the basic level, particularly on the secondary level in Thailand. So that was the difference between the countries when they started what I then are talking about, this industrial deepening and upgrading policies. You have these basic differences between the two countries. Now I turn to the more specific findings in relation to the different areas. And I might not get through all the things, but I'm trying to do it. I start with a petrochemical. I look at a petrochemical industry in both countries, and it's a kind of industrial deepening where, I think quite sensibly, they try to build up the petrochemical industry instead of importing, for example, plastic resin, which is the thing I've been looking at. What I found was more similarities than expected. There were more similarities in the sense that in both cases you had state control and state leadership. And I think the planning process in these two cases were not that different. In Thailand you had the PTT, the Petroleum Authority of Thailand, and in Taiwan you had the Chinese Petroleum Company, and it was more or less similar the way they organized things. And then further downstream, midstream, you had these large, well-connected, ironic, domestic conglomerates. In Taiwan, you had Konosopatic, here you had CPI, or you had CM Cement. And in one way or the other, they were well-connected, but not in the same way. So there were, I think, many similarities when I look at the economic organization in this petrochemical industry. When I look at policy, there were also many similarities, basically. In both cases, I would argue there was a fairly coherent and fairly effective implementation of these petrochemical policies. Both countries had entry control, and it makes sense in that sector to have entry control, because if you get too many firms inside, you can't get economies of scale. So in that sense, normally you would have some kind of entry control in this business. And normally you would also have favorable incentives that give some risk, give some risk absorption. And you had that in those cases, both in Taiwan and Thailand. In both cases, there was a management of trade. In Thailand, you had a 40% tax, import tax. So it's possible for firms to put prices just below these 40%, or around these 40%, above the world market level. It was a bit different in Taiwan, because in Taiwan, the government forced the resin producers to deliver a certain amount of resins of a certain quality to a price around the world's market price, because that was necessary for downstream users to have price at that level, because if it was not at that level, the textile industry and the plastic industry, shoe industry and all that could not compete, and that is what they should do in that period. They should export to the US, to Europe, etc. So they had to have a price, input price level around the world price. Of course, there are transport costs, but it had to be around that level. And in fact, they were policed by the state to do that. But then the state gave them subsidy, in the sense they gave them very cheap feedstock. So they got cheap feedstock, but had to accept prices around the world market level. That was not the case in Thailand. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was. You had this agreement where you had a cost-plus price model in the beginning, and then moved to a market, more market-like. But the same happened in Taiwan. But the market price that was chosen in Taiwan was very favorable because it does. It depends on which market you're looking at. And in the case of Taiwan, they chose the market with the cheapest feedstock prices. So actually, there was quite a large subsidy in Taiwan to these racing producers. But then they had access to deliver downstream at this lower price than in Thailand. So there was this difference. Because what producers I talked with years back said was that they priced just below the import tax. And at that stage, it was slightly below it. At that stage, it was 40% because there had been this after process going on. Then, I've said about feedstock pricing, that's the next point. Then in both countries, there was around 1990 a process of liberalization, a trade liberalization, an age control liberalization. But then in Thailand, there was also a external financial liberalization. That's the difference. There were no external financial liberalization in Taiwan, and also for security reasons, for other reasons that had to do with politics. But in Thailand, there was this liberalization, which also led to this investment boom from 92 to 96 in petrochemicals, and then ended up in all the problems during the financial crisis, and then it ended up with the TPI went down, the CN Cement and PCG was the big, were the two companies left more or less in the case of Thailand. And in this field, it was different in Taiwan, where you had no financial liberalization. Because the state banks, kept tight control over the domestic credit market, but also on the capital accounts. So there was no capital account liberalization that could be used in the same manner. Then, of course, some companies could move to China and invest there, some Taiwanese companies. And then they did that, like for most of plastic. They also went to the US and invested there. Well, giveaway subsidies, let's call it that. So what you did by having this that allowed pricing, let's say 40% above world market prices, is a subsidy. So, and that's the difference that in the case of Taiwan, there was not that. They managed, they simply managed the trade in the sense that there were quotas as to whether you couldn't just export. So there was a management of both import and export. So you simply managed the whole system. And then, I don't remember exactly how they did this pricing. I mean, there was also some kind of agreement, because it was a cost-plus one in the beginning that was more market-driven. I don't know exactly the technicalities. I think I've written them somewhere in my... Then if I look at the institutional arrangements, then I think in both cases there were these kind of pilot agencies. There was a bureaucratic expertise. In the case of Thailand, you had this BTIG Institute, the Petrochemical Institute, that did have knowledge in this field and were able to intervene in the negotiations with the downstreams. Yeah. And there was also this CIPO in the Eastern Seaboard. There was a particular center that sometime in history was involved, the CIPO, a part of the Eastern Seaboard program. And similarly in Taiwan, you had a particular section of the Industrial Development Bureau that was involved in these kinds of things. I think in both cases there were particularistic state business interaction. Individual businessmen had individual contacts with the state, in both cases. In the case of Taiwan, with the party also. Because what I'm talking about is negotiations about the NPC 1 and NPC 2. I mean, in these negotiations on how to organize the chemical industry, the PTIG was used, and I might not have so much knowledge, I think, as kind of expertise in these negotiations on behalf of the state. Thai state, I might be wrong. There's the same industry, but they have an expertise, technically. Yeah, okay. Yeah, but it's not that state. I take that one. Yep. Then I think it was this similarity that in both cases you have this particularistic state business interactions. So when individual firms have individual negotiations in Taiwan or in Thailand, so it was not institutionalized. Of course, you had trade associations, but they were not that strong. They entered in various kinds of trade negotiations later on, but in the beginning it was much more individual based in both cases. But of course, there was a difference that what you ended up with in Thailand was world-class producers. In the PVC, it was most plastic. In ABS, it was Chimai company. Of course, you could argue now there are also world-class producers in Thailand because there's a lot of export of petrochemicals. But that could also be linked to how the foreign exchange had moved up and down. So but we can discuss that. So actually what I find is that a lot of similarities in the petrochemicals, that it is a kind of problem of efficiency in Thailand. It's been mentioned in Musket's book on the Fish Tiger many years back, that there was something special about the tourism industry and the petrochemical industry. I think as far as my looking at the petrochemical industry, I think it's fairly efficient driven compared to other types of intermediate sector. I think I'll leave it there. Then I think let's do it a bit more briefly with the other points. My second area was this SME linkage and supplier development policies. And because they are important, that's an important type of strategic industrial policy if you want to deepen import substitution in industry or deepen export-oriented industry. So if you try to avoid the shallowness that people talk about, then this kind of deepening is important. And we can discuss why it's important, but I'll leave it here. What I found here was also more similarities than I had expected. I think in neither of the two countries I found what I call a comprehensive linkage and supply development policy. Thailand is quite famous for its BOI, the dual program. If you look at the UNCTAD world called report, World Investment Report some years back, they write a lot about this dual program. But basically we're talking about 10 people and not that large a program and large funding. It's quite famous. I don't think it's that important. If you look at Taiwan, it's very famous for a so-called Center Satellite Factory Program. It's famous for having ensure that the transnational companies or the big companies have their satellites. So the big companies are centered and have some satellites. When I looked at it, well, they spend a lot of money on it in Taiwan, but to my knowledge, it's more kind of window dressing for the KMC party, because they did not have that much contact with small companies because they came from mainland. So basically, both countries are not that impressed about having a comprehensive linkage and supply of mainland program. But it might be that some staff has a disagree on this. But let's see. Then I did not find a comprehensive and coherent SME policy. I did find it in Thailand up to 2001 at least. I'm quite sure. There was not a comprehensive one. Of course, in the late 90s, you had this SME law, you had Osmith, and all kinds of things coming up. The same happened in Thailand from 1986 and forward. Legislation, various agencies, various committees, and all that. So it's a parallel process. But it did not add up to, at least not up to 2001 in Thailand, to what I call comprehensive and coherent policy program. So there's certain similarities there. Where in Thailand or in Thailand? So that's right. And that's a major difference to Taiwan. Taiwan had a lot of data. There was not a data problem. But then I found also differences. When I went out here, and I won't go into details here, I looked at financial assistance, and there was actually some financial assistance programs in Taiwan that worked. There was not much of it working in Thailand, so there was a difference. Then I looked at technical assistance, particularly in relation to plastic parts and molds and dies. And so today, brief here, when I looked at the molds and dies, there was a very big difference in the molds and dies approach. What happened in Taiwan after 1986, that's when small-scale industries began to move after the FAFTA agreement and other things happened there. They moved to Thailand, Vietnam, and also started moving to China. Then there was a shift in policy, and there was much focus on technical assistance to the mold and die. Producers took them to stay. So there were all kinds of changes. There was a lot of engineers being educated in this field. There was a lot of private consultancy firms around. There was a lot of state support around. All kinds of support. So when I looked at the mold and die in particular, more than the plastic parts, there was this huge difference. That also, I mean, if you look at two countries, what we've seen in Thailand is that it's mostly foreign producers that now dominate the mold and die, and coming from Japan or Germany, while in Taiwan, by the mid-1990s, it was the fifth largest producer of molds in the world, and they were able to produce up to 90% of all types of molds. There was a tremendous difference, particularly in that particular field that I will be looking at. Then, of course, there were other policies in Taiwan that had to be looked upon. One is that they actually had a critical component and product program starting in the early 90s, where they discovered that they spent a lot of money to import components from Japan, and then they started a very focused program to get rid of some of that import by developing these critical components themselves. There were programs on that. There's, of course, also a major difference in the sense that what you have in Taiwan was the OEM strategy. Most producers in Taiwan were part of this OEM strategy, where it's not transnational companies, it's local companies that produce on OEM basis for foreign buyers or foreign firms. While in Taiwan, at least during the late 80s and forward, there's been much more emphasis on the FDI strategy, where the focus is on getting transnational companies to produce various goods and components in the electronic industry or the car industry. So there's this huge difference in the kind of strategy that has been followed, and that has an impact also on the things I've been talking about. Now I think Sabul will soon stop me, so I'll just say that I have also been looking at an industrial technology policy. I've not been doing a full analysis of the so-called national innovation system in Thailand or in Taiwan. I think Padapong has done that for Thailand. So with this stuff, what I've been doing is to compare, in particular, four different types of policies to see what extent that they could be implemented in an adequate sense, in a coherent sense. I looked at importing foreign technology. When I went to this field, industrial technology policy, there was considerable cross-national differences. In all these fields, I found huge differences between Taiwan and Thailand. If you look at importing foreign technology, I mean, there was a policy, as I mentioned, in Taiwan. All technology contracts were screened in order to limit import of obsolete technologies, reduce royalty payments, avoid restriction clauses, all kinds of screening, at least in the early period. There was a policy towards foreign direct investments, I mentioned that. There was, of course, as many of you know, these various technology, science and technology institutes that serve as a kind of transfer agency for foreign technology. So ITRI is one such well-known agency, but there were other agencies involved in transferring technology from abroad to various sectors in the private economy in Taiwan. I didn't think there were similar things going on in Thailand. If you look at private sector technology efforts, at an early stage, there were a lot of similarities. There weren't that much private sector R&D, even in Taiwan. But it shifted around the mid-80s, when there was a comprehensive support program in Taiwan that supported a range of innovation activities, and that I think were quite adequately orchestrated. And in fact, the share of private sector or business sector R&D went up from 36% in 1985 to 58% 10 years later. So from 36% to 58%, more than 10 years later. And apart from that, there was substantial non-R&D innovations, a lot of innovations, all kinds of innovations going on by means of reverse engineering or by learning from exporting or learning through other systems. So there was a substantial, I think, difference between Taiwan and Thailand. Then there was a difference also in institutional support from public research institutes. Just as we mentioned, if you look at Thailand, most research has been concentrated on agriculture and health, a strong focus like in Taiwan. 88% of all public research went to engineering. So this is a huge difference between what the public sector focused on. So the focus on industry and particular focus on engineering in the case of Taiwan. Then when it comes to S&T manpower in Taiwan, there was a process where the state very successively and very forcefully channeled the students first into vocational training, and not just vocational training, but science and engineering. They couldn't just go to take their business degree that not everybody would. They had to go to science and technology, and then you had what was called a closed gate to the temporary level, so you concentrated the education at the secondary level for some period. Then it opened the gate, and then it channeled all the students to the next layer, to the tertiary education. But there you could not go to social science or something, you had to go for science and engineering. So again, the same process went on. So if you look at statistics, you'll see a lot of students, they might like to go for liberal arts or social science, but in the end, they were forced more or less to go to science and technology. For that reason, there is a lot of engineers around in Taiwan in all areas. The same stuff happened, as you know, in Thailand. It has happened in Denmark. That's why you can survive in social science still. But it might change. Then finally, what I've then been doing is to go and look at the general institutional arrangement and the social political underpinnings. What I find here is that there's a strong difference between the two countries. There has been a strong political motivation in Taiwan for a lot of good reasons. Externally, there was a strong focus on technology. There was also a strong focus on plastic resins, because that's important if you want to produce weapons. So the reason why semiconductors, and they say the plastic shaker, got so much support was not just because it was clever from an economic perspective, it was also needed because the US withdraw a lot of its support and Taiwan build up its own weapons industry, defense industry. And for that purpose, you need microprocessors, you also need advanced plastic products. But that was another motivation. Then, of course, there was a difference in the sense that Taiwan, the only way for local Taiwanese to move was to go to industry. They couldn't get employment in the public sector because that would be. So they had to move to the industry, but there was also internal political need for having this industrial transformation going on all the time. As you can see, I have also been looking at the internal organization of the state and the public private sector interaction. Concerning the first point, the internal organization, I think the two most important thing is that there was a difference between Taiwan, which had a single party based authoritarian state, while in Thailand you had what are called short-lived or short-living coalition governments. So that's a very important difference. Then in Taiwan, you had a coherent industrial policy, a strong industrial policy ministries. If you look at Thailand, the Minister of Industry and the Minister of Technology are not the high-ranking one, I suppose, still here. So that this is a huge difference between also the ranking of various ministries and the way they are organized together. So it was much more coherent in the case of Taiwan. I'm not saying that everything was coherent and there were no inter-bureaucratic fights in Taiwan or Christmas, as in Denmark, as everywhere, but it was not on the same scale as quite in Thailand. So that's much about the internal organization of the state. Concerning the public-private sector collaboration, Taiwan was not really the type of institutionalized cooperation for the good reason that you had a lot of small-scale industry, they were local Taiwanese. They had a KMD party, they were coming from China. They were two different groups, so it's not quite obvious how they should meet and collaborate. But you have some large conglomerates which have the good links to the KMD party, etc., etc. So, and you had, I think in both cases, the trade associations were weak. Basically, the Thailand trade associations at the sectoral level or the general level are fairly weak when it comes to this kind of interaction when it comes to industrial upgrading. And that's also the case in Taiwan. The trade associations are not that important when it comes to this kind of situation. And finally, when you look at Taiwan, During the 90s, there was a process of democratization in Taiwan, and during that process, the KMC elite, the political elite, and the economic elite began to collaborate much more, also on an institutional basis. But I think a main difference between Taiwan and Thailand was that the KMC party had its own funding, so they did not rely on funding from private firms. They had their own KMC sector. They had the party-owned enterprises and the state-owned enterprises to some extent, so they had money. So in that sense, they kept a certain autonomy against business, even though they interacted very closely and particularistically with business. That's the final point. I think that of course there was a lot of corruption around in Taiwan. A lot of it was on the local level, provincial and local level, and that's what's being displayed now. There was certainly all the corruption at the central level. But I think it could be argued that the constituencies of autonomy, where you could have the industrial technology policy, and the constituency of patronage could be the Ministry of Transport, the Ministry of Telecommunications, the Ministry of some other ministries, were, so to speak, so much divided, at least during the KMT period, that there was a space for more long-term oriented policy. But obviously, we know that in South Korea and Taiwan and in China, we'll learn in the future, there's a tremendous amount of corruption around. And that's also why I start. That's my last word. I did start with good governance, because if I start with good governance, I would end up saying that, well, you didn't have that good governance in Taiwan, but that's probably changing. In Thailand, it's either China or etc. It's not that good governance. So the main difference, I think, when it comes to these areas, are not whether you have good governance or corruption or not in one place or the other. It's the nature of that corruption. Point one, point two, it's more about whether you have the kind of developmental governance or not. And in that case, I think what I showed was that Thailand, yes, had it in the petrochemical industry to some extent. It's my try, at least. But when it comes to areas like industrial technology policy, innovation policy, I think it's a very poor developmental governance in this case compared to what happened in Taiwan, in particular in Taiwan since 1986. So that's what I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Ravi. Before I open, please, any question? Any question? Any argument? Okay,
Your finding is quite your finding surprised me quite a bit. In the sense that you point out to the similarities between the two rather than the differences between the two. Could you suggest what may be the difference between the outcome of the two?
Well, first of all, I think that was my starting point in the finding number. Let's see. This one. Of course, there is, at a basic level, a major difference between having the easy cook EOI strategy and the one we see in Thailand. So there's a basic difference that has to be taken into account. And that links to what I said. You had, in fact, a comprehensive industrial policy from the beginning. So I start with a country with a comprehensive industrial policy in place and a country where I do not see that. Okay. When I look at specific areas, I think the main difference comes when I look at load and buy and industrial technology policy. That while Thailand might not be that different from Taiwan when it comes to industrial deepening, when it comes to industrial upgrading, the closer you get to industrial upgrading, the larger the difference. So if you go to the right, you have a lot of differences. If you go to the left, you have less differences. And of course, what's important, at least what the World Bank would argue, to get out of this middle income crisis, then you need to go to the right. You need to have this continuous innovation in some sector. That was also what Thaksin actually is trying to argue, getting Michael Porter to town and paying rather than $1 million something, in order to point at some sectors that could be relevant, etc. So I mean, there's probably much disagreement about that. If you want to move to a more rewarding path of industrialization, I'm talking about industrialization, we could talk about agriculture or tourism, industrialization, then you have to move to the right. And my impression was that up to 2001, that's where the report stopped. It was not that impressive. Then I looked at the Thaksin period. There's a more focused approach, but in the end, that's 2006, September. It's still not that. I mean, there's still a lot of path dependency in the sense, there's still a lot of shifting coalition government, a lot of reshuffling, there's a lot of factors that mean that, as far as I argue in that paper, I might be wrong, even during the more focused taxing period, for the reasons I also try to list in the paper, Thailand did not move that far in the right area. Because we could disagree there.
Can I follow up? Can I make one of the points? If you It means that, in general, can I say that, when I'm moving to the right, the path of upgrading in general is more difficult than deepening, right? In that sense. According to my understanding, is what you are saying. Deepening is more difficult or upgrading is
okay.
More difficult.
Okay, what I said was, you asked whether what's the real difference between Taiwan and Thailand. Then I say the real difference in what has been going on in the field I've been looking at is that if you look at the left from here and over there, then let it start for deepening. Then, as in the chemical industry at least, there were a lot of similarities. Then I moved to the right, the industrial upgrading. Then the more I moved to the right, the more differences between the two cases. Then comes the question, is it more difficult to move to, is it more difficult to have industrial upgrading than industrial deepening? Then the answer is yes. Because if you look at the chemical industry, what we're talking about is to get some kind of cooperation between three large conglomerates and the state. And to make a deal between upstreamers and downstreamers and all that. Because it's complicated, but I mean, it's manageable. There's only three, four players. I mean, if we're talking about the kind of national innovation systems that Barbara Bong and others have written about, we're talking about creating linkages in the whole national innovation system in order to boost innovation. And that's much more cooperation, it's much more difficult. So I think you're right that it is more difficult, but what I argue is that countries like Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore have achieved that. Then it might be it was another time in history. So you could argue, well, if they want to take history into account, it might be easier because Taiwan and South Korea followed a new mercantilist strategy. They were allowed to sell their goods in the U.S. And up to 85, 86, it was a free lunch. They could just keep on producing, and the U.S. took it. That's not necessarily the case in the same way today. So there are certain differences between being in 1980 and being in 1990. I haven't mentioned them, but I think that they should be taken into account more than I've done in my study, that one should be systematic about the readable and international differences. But I mean, at least the World Bank believes that it is possible to come out of the middle income crisis. That still has to be proven whether we're now in a frozen situation where you can just stay in the civic periphery, if we use the words of the old time. You can move from periphery to civic periphery, you can't move to the center, but for a lot of reasons. Or whether it's still possible for some countries to move off, as Taiwan, South Korea, and other countries have been doing. Suppose that's an empirical question. We'll see whether it's Thailand with the fish tiger.
So, if you were to conclude what is the most important factor, in fact, I think the matter is not whether it's industrial deepening or industrial upgrading. It's the factors behind, the factor that explain the industrial deepening and industrial upgrading. You see, so there are many factors which I don't know whether I haven't read your book, but I think, for example, the manpower development, the technology development and things like that, you see. These are among the very important factors. So if you were to conclude, what do you think what are the most important factors behind the more successful performance of Taiwan versus Thailand?
Yeah, I think it's important to note what I've been saying is how they have performed as far as particular kind of policies is concerned. And then I try to argue that's a likely impact from these policies. But it might well be there are other factors, non-policy factors, that have been important by one. I'm touched upon that now, but I think that should be mentioned because I think if I look more generally at Taiwan and Thailand, not just these policy upgrading, then I think one ought to have to take agriculture in account. I mean, the trajectory of the growth in Taiwan and Thailand also differs in the sense that from an early stage, it was one quite intensive growth in Taiwan. The agricultural was a land reform and agricultural revolution made in the 50s. And it went to a green revolution before people talk about the green revolution. So that process was a transformed agriculture into intensive agriculture. While in Thailand, it's been extensive agriculture. Then when you move to industry, then at least at some stage, industrialization moves to what we call intensive industrialization upgrades evening. While I think in Thailand, it was much more extensive. So this huge difference between them. Extensive process in Thailand for good reasons. There's much more resources, natural resources, in more space for land, etc. But still, there's a difference. Extensive, intensive. But I think that's a major overall difference. And that relates also to state intervention. It was the state that made the land reforms supported by the Americans. They didn't do that for economic reasons. They did it to a large extent for political reasons, but in the end, it had economic impact. See, a lot of the things that happened in Taiwan that turned out to be developmental in an economic sense were not thought out only as a smart thing to do. For each transformation, as I mentioned, the weapon industry, the defense industry, etc., there was also kind of political logic each time, so there was an urgency to do it. And of course, in the case of Thailand, there had not been that urgency. The urgency had not been in the private sector. But I think they've kept on the extension way of doing it, getting the technology, getting some investment, keep going. And the public sector have also supported all this extensive thing. Compared to Taiwan, where all the time was the state and pushed for intensive agrarian development, intensive manufacturing, and now it's intensive service, etc. So this main difference on extensive, intensive, I don't know whether that makes sense, extensive, intensive. Yeah.
In your other paper, I have read the other paper, you mentioned a lot about policy. I think what makes difference in fact Thailand and many other countries is the effective implementation of policy. If you look at policy statement, many things are there. But if you really look at it closely, many of the policies are not implemented. Even many of these policies that you mentioned about the Thaksin government, in fact, many of them are not effectively implemented. So we have to really look at and if you want to dig deep a little bit, you want to ask why these policies are not effectively implemented. In fact, in the past many years, we have recommended many things to the Thai government only to find that many of them are not really implemented. And that's the important difference.
I think it's very important. That's basically what I've been doing on these 1,000 pages, trying to look at implementation. And in fact, in the paper that was distributed, tried to list some of the political logic behind the Thaksin period that makes it not that easy to implement this if you also want to survive politically. But I think this whole issue of effective or ineffective implementation is important. What surprised me was when I came the first time to study this about politics, I went to some of the reports from 1983 made by the World Bank, I don't know if we were involved. I looked at various chapters in these, what's called industrial restructuring reports, something. They were somewhere, there was a lot of dust on them. But if you look at the details in the areas I was interested in, the mold and dye and all that, I mean, all these good suggestions were there in 1983. I got the impression it was a kind of window dressing for the World Bank, so when they left, the report was less. But in a sense, the same. Yeah, the Swedish. Yeah. Yes, but you have all these also, a lot of reports also on engineering and very detailed reports. And basically nothing happened for a lot of good or bad reasons, I agree with that. But then there have been a lot of reports I've gone through. I mean, all the good suggestions about a strategic industrial policy are around, not all the time, but there have been a lot of suggestions, like Zach said, around. So there's a lot of good reports for foreigners to read about what could be done.
Okay, I have all.
I think one of the factors that contribute to the difference between the two countries is that our industrial policy never have the ingredient of technological and innovation upgrading from the very beginning until just a few years ago. In Taiwan, this is very explicit that one main of the economic policy is to develop industrial indigenous technological capabilities, especially to strengthen the capability of the private sector firms. But this is not explicit at all in the Thai case. Yeah. For example, we have an R&D tax incentive, but it's only implemented in the late 1990s. In other countries, implemented long time ago, in 70s, in 80s. And also in Taiwan, they have a lot of grant incentives, specifically given to the firms that want to upgrade technology. They have so many schemes that want firm to come up with a new idea, a new product to the market. But this is not happening in Thailand in the past, from the fear of corruption or whatever. But this is, it means that the policy itself is just want to look at the industrial development without taking into the root, that is the develop indigenous technological capabilities of the private firms. And one, why this is happening? Because people who control economic policy in the country in the past used to be neoclassical economists. And people who control the policy in Taiwan, they are not. They are, for example, K.T. Lee is an engineer. She's not an economist. So, and he controlled Ministry of Finance for many years. So he put the policy to develop industrial technology at the heart of economic policy. That's one of the explanations. And if you look at the in Taiwan, the Ministry of Economic Affairs is the ministry that really push for industrial technology deepening. But in the Thai Ministry of Industry, this did not happen at all. I think this is because of the way the bureaucracy works in the different countries, totally different. And when in Thailand we have the Ministry of Science and Technology, but it's mostly controlled by the scientists who only think about the supply side, to develop human resource, to develop the testing laboratories, but not developing capabilities in the firms. They perceive firms as a user of technology that developed by R&D institutes. And those R&D institutes, when they look at the R&D project, they did not formulate the project in order to help the industry. But most of the time, they do it for their curiosity. So that's why we have the two group of people, neoclassical economists, who never think about developing indigenous technology capabilities. They think that the market can do the job, so this is not happening in Taiwan. On the other hand, we have the scientists who think about developing the supply side without thinking about creating the demand for the industry to use technology and deepening the skill. And also education. Education, we have the educator that did not pay a lot of attention to technical education. This is very different from Taiwan, that they pay a lot of attention to technicians. So we are just emphasized on general education without so much investment in technical education at the technician level, and also the societal bias that if you study in a technical school, you are inferior to the one who goes to university. That is a lot of the difference. So the difference lies in the underneath thinking of the policy maker, educator, scientist, economist. That is one of my ideas.
I think you have mentioned just briefly the education. I think that is very important. In the 1960s, you see, when we were studying in the U.S., you can see that 10 people from Taiwan, at least 8 of them, study science and engineering. You see, and I have bought so many textbooks in English in Taiwan. Very cheap. You see, and all these Taiwanese students, they can read textbook in the school year, in the university year, something like that. And many of them come back to Taiwan. You see, so they have built up a very strong foundation of manpower, whereas Thailand is almost totally lacking. I think that is one factor that explains the difference.
Professor, could you please go back to your slide on institutional capacity?
Your main approach to institutional capacity?
Yeah, that's one.
It is my personal interest. If I'm going to ask you, what is your answer? What is the main difference? What is the main difference of institutional configuration between Thai and Taiwan to generate the difference in institutional capacity?
I think we have mentioned differences concerning the internal organization. I mean, if we talk about the middle level, that's state capacity, what they can do. If we talk about down is what the state actually do. But if we talk about what the capacity thing, there are many differences in the internal organization. One is that you have trade and technology policy industrialization coupled together. You have engineers, I mean, you were talking about whether we could draw a conclusion that had the impact that Kwata Pong mentioned. I don't know, but it was mainly engineers. Then you had a very high level of information. That's what we talked about earlier, there's a lag of information, small killings. There's a tremendous amount of information that's been collected by various agencies about all kinds of sectors, very detailed, and that means made a difference. What I said was when I went to the state industry, then it was not as kind of new Iberian theory would say. Let's say quite important to have institutionalized connections between state and industry. In Taiwanese case, it's a kind of anomaly. It was basically KET state that had a commanding height, and they were the ones trying to make the kind of policy networks down in society or in the business sector. So in that sense, it was not before the mid-90s that there was a kind of institutional collaboration coming on. But that's also parallel with the shift to more high technology. So when it happened that Taiwan had to shift to high tech, that was also the period of democratization, not by a link. And during that period, people came back from the U.S. That's the period where large firms began to collaborate much more intensively with the state. So at that stage, where you have industrial upgrading going on, and where it's important to get information from the private sector, it happened to be a period in time in history where you had this kind of interaction. While earlier, it was quite difficult for the state to get the information. They tried to collect the information. There are all kinds of investigations, but I mean, the private sector, the small-scale enterprise, were not that interested in linking up with the KNC for political reasons. But that changed from 1986-87 because of this process of democratization starting in Taiwan, and I put a chapter on how that affects the interaction. But in earlier on, there was not that kind of developmental collaboration, as in South Korea, where you have the big giant ball sitting together with the president and making all kinds of deals. That was not the case. It was the KMC. That KMC tried to avoid local conglomerates. They have an anti-concentration policy. So one reason for supporting small-scale industry, to the extent they were able to it, was politically, they did not want a strong economic elite to challenge their power in China. So there's a lot of politics, that's why I have this politics in the title. For everything, I think, there's also policy, there's the technocrats, the clever guys, the engineers, that we don't talk about, but there's also the politics that plays, I think, an important role. So I think it's important to move from the middle level, the more technocratic level, to take politics into account, to look at the KMT, who did they support, what was their strategy, how did they survive, and all that stuff. And what did the U.S. do in relation to Taiwan to understand why it's different. It's not just because the engineers are clever guys, it's also because there was an urgency, a push, a political push, but that changed over time. But there I've been trying to track, not in relation to agricultural transformation, because I've not covered that, but it was the whole story about Taiwan. Then I think it's important to look at agricultural transformation, because that's where it started, that you had this tremendous productivity growth from mid-60s and up. In the early 60s, Taiwan was an important exporter of asparagus and some of these mushrooms and all that. And that was an important part of the history. So the Taiwan history do not start as late as I have presented it. So what's your answer?
Your paper based on the real sectors in industries. So I'm wondering whether some part of your studies touch upon the difference in the capital market between Thailand and Taiwan.
Yeah, what I've been doing is
even monetary policy, which supports industrial policy.
I'm not generally looked at macroeconomic policies, but I look at the role of capital, because that's important for finance, small scale industry for financing this big up operating thing, and a decent thing too. I mean, both countries, there was a quite conservative bank sector, because the main difference was because in Thailand it was a private commercial bank sector, with these links with to conglomerate, but in Taiwan it was a state run banking sector, apart from the very low level where you had. But the things we talked about, it was state-run, state-owned, but also conservative. It was, I think, at the same time of conservatism, there were nobody really in the state sector that wanted, the state bank sector that wanted to invest. Well, they wanted a lot of collateral, they wanted to be sure, because, so I think those cases, actually, it was a conservative bank policy. But then in the case of Taiwan, the state established other intermediaries, like small scale bank, and they played some role, but basically the small companies had to go to the informal market, and the informal market was accepted by the state. So it was accepted that this informal curb sector played an important role. So that in both cases it's a bank-based financial systems until Taiwan established all kinds of venture capital systems, etc. And of course there was also stock exchange. But basically it was a bank-based in both cases. It was conservative. The informal sector, I studied that in the Thai context, so it was quite important in the Taiwanese context. What more? Then of course there was a different dimension concerning liberalization in Taiwan. In Thailand in 1991, well, that did not happen in Taiwan. They kept closed capital accounts. They got through the Asian crisis reasonably. They kept their very large huge foreign reserve that they keep for political reasons. They keep 100 or so billion US dollars normally. And to keep that in case something happens, then it's always nice to have 100 billion US dollars in case something happens with China, because that's
all the time the question, what is the relationship with China? I talk about relationship with U.S., but relationship with mainland China, because I'm important in all kinds of decisions going on in Taiwan. I have a look at monetary policy and other kinds of macroeconomic policies. Not that it's not important to look at the differences, but I'm not done that. I'm not done it.
Any questions? Okay, it's time to finish. Thank you very much for possibly now this to give a lecture for us possibly. Okay, at the end, I would like to ask Dr. Mahia to give a written token to Professor Lawley. In case our students are interested to study further in Denmark, Lok Student is a very nice university. It's a little bit cold, but it's very nice.
It's expression at the moment, you must admit. But it gets better with global warming. So in a few years' time, it might be reasonable. I'd like to thank you for coming and listening. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
ค่ะอาจารย์ค่ะอาจารย์เอ๊ะเก็บเราดาวโหลดจาก